to the Blue Collar Zen Podcast, recorded here at the Detroit Zen Center. Welcome back to the podcast. Today's story is called Tumble Down Sage, and it's being read by Sunim out of the book Chuang Tzu, translated by David Hinton.
In Lu, there was a man named Tumble Down Imperial who'd committed a crime and so had his foot cut off. As he wandered, he was followed by as many disciples as Confucius. "Tumble Down Imperial has only one foot," said Constant Season to Confucius. "And yet Lu is divided evenly between his followers and yours. He never teaches when he stands up and never talks when he sits down. Still, people keep going to him empty and returning home full. Is there really some wordless teaching, some formless way of bringing the mind to realization? What kind of a man could this be?"
"A master sage," replied Confucius. "If I weren't so backward and slow, I'd be following him too. And if I need such a teacher, is it any wonder that others need him even more? Why just the kingdom of Lu? Let's bring the whole world along and we'll all go follow him."
"He's lost his foot," said Constant Season, "but he's still like a king to you. He's far beyond ordinary people. The way he employs mine, it's like no one else. How does he do it?"
"Birth and death are certainly great events," explained Confucius. "But for him, they change nothing. All heaven and earth could be churned over and falling apart. But for him, nothing would be lost. He inquires where nothing is false, and he isn't tossed about as things shift back and forth. He knows that the endless transformation of things unfurls according to its inevitable nature, and he holds fast to the ancestral source."
"Meaning what?"
asked Constant Season. "If you see the world in terms of difference," replied Confucius, "there are liver and gallbladder. There are Chu lands and Yue lands. But seen in terms of sameness, the 10,000 things are all one. If you understand this, you forget how eye and ear would love this and hate that. Then the mind wanders the accord of integrity. And if you see the identity of things, you see there can be no loss. So it is that he saw nothing more in a lost foot than a clump of dirt tossed aside."
"He's utterly self-contained," marveled Constant Season. "He uses understanding to reach mind. He uses mind to reach timeless mind. So why do all the things gather around him?"
"People can't see themselves in rushing water," began Confucius. "They see themselves in still water, for only stillness can still stillness. Of those who owe their nature to earth, only pines and cedars remain resolute, forever green through summer and winter. Of those who owe their nature to heaven, only emperors Yao and Shun remain resolute, sovereign at the head of all 10,000 things. Because they were able to make their own lives resolute, they were able to make all life resolute. Confucius went on, preserving the subtleties of origin, that is an act of fearlessness. A brave warrior seeking praise and renown may attack mighty armies alone. And if a man can do such a thing out of mere ambition, what can you do when all heaven and earth is your palace, and the 10,000 things are your treasure house, when the eyes and ears are empty windows, and the body is mere lodging place, when all that can be known is one and the same, and the mind is deathless? Someone like that just picks a day and rises out of this unreal world. Is it any wonder that followers gather around? But the things of this world would never concern such a person.
It almost seems like it almost doesn't seem right to speak after hearing that. So then what do you think it takes to arrive at that place that you truly rise above worldly concerns and become, there was one line in there that really struck me, that the eyes and ears become windows and the body just a resting place or a place to abide. How do you view the path for us as individuals to arrive to that place where we're truly open in the way that Confucius is describing, without an agenda?
Well, the first thing is that there just aren't people that have done it alone. And this is yet another example of why people follow someone like Tumbledown Imperial. He had something special, that's all they knew.
Yeah.
And he couldn't put it into words.
Yeah.
But he lived it in front of them and with them.
Yeah.
So I think when you ask such a question, and I know from my own experience that you'd like to know quickly how to do such a thing. But it's unfortunate that we've built up all kinds of, and I'm going to use the word karma, but I simply mean when you look at the things that you've established in your life, that's your karma. And so when I say to a Zen student, you have to just let it go.
Yeah.
But it's not magic in allowing yourself to be in an environment where letting go is what's happening. Mm. And it's the only thing that is causing us to not know that we're already whole and complete. In Zen, we call it, Buddha nature. And that Buddha nature, sentient beings, and mind, are one and the same.
Yeah.
And this whole story is about that, recognizing the sameness of everything when you're seeing reality, and that your attachment to the things that appear, the characteristics and the appearances in the world, when we attach to them, it isn't a matter of whether it's good or bad. It's neither. It's just kind of interference.
Yeah. Yeah, the first part of the story describes Tumbledown as a man who's had his foot chopped off. And it's
the consequence, isn't it,
right,
of his action. He was a thief.
Right. And that, I mean, there's a few things there, you know, the idea of redemption. But in this way, in this context, redemption is not just a some sort of metaphysical or emotional redemption, but a, you know, clearly by the description and the admiration of Confucius and all of these people who've been drawn to this former thief, clearly there was some profound thing that happened as a result of his action. He had his foot chopped off. I mean, what a terrible thing on the one hand to have happened to you. And yet I can imagine, if I think about that in my own life, what that would do. You know, you would have a profound wake-up call. So I guess I'm sort of stuck on, in a positive sense, I'm sort of really struck by this, that, our bad conduct even can eventually lead to our own spiritual awakening, in a sense that now he's become someone that other people are able to witness as a free being. But it didn't come cheap. It wasn't an easy path. Very touching.
It's also, I think, we had a story some time back about piglets with mother.
Yeah.
And the person watching them, they were all nursing with mother, and unbeknownst to them, the physical body of their mother was going to pass away in the next few moments.
Yeah.
And when it did, they immediately left.
Right.
Because no longer could they find the similarity between themselves and mother.
Right.
And I think that's when we follow people.
Yeah.
And it isn't that Confucius wasn't a pretty great sage, but he recognized humbly something that was even beyond him.
Yeah.
Suggesting that maybe we should be following him, and we should get all of these two kingdoms following him.
Yeah.
Knowing that, of course, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
So in that sense, Confucius could be viewed as a stepping stone.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful character, often is referred to as a sage.
Yeah.
But it's how, I guess you would say, sages work together.
Yeah.
Even in unbeknownst to each other, they understand the way things are, and they don't try to make themselves out to be something special. And they freely can point to someone else that's more special than they are.
Yeah. Yeah, that level of, that kind of humility is very eye-opening and very attractive. The other thing, Sundam, that hits me about the story is that there was no description exactly of what Tumbledown was teaching. I mean, I think at some point they mentioned that he doesn't really speak, but it was who he was. So the subtle message there was that people were following him, and even apparently, I guess you can kind of, it's implied or inferred that they're able to follow his teachings, even though he's not actually giving a verbal teaching, but just by the quality of who he actually is. And Confucius is describing him as a being, a human, that is manifesting oneness or experiencing, seeing beyond the division of things and coming from a place of oneness. And so I find that really beautiful, that they're not talking about his teachings, they're not describing anything verbally, but I guess the implication there is that people can just tell by the way he appears in the world that this is an awakened being. And so they want to be around that, kind of like bees to honey. And I wonder if you could maybe talk about, I mean, your teachers, you never spoke the same language as your own teachers. And yet you knew that there was something there for you to study with. So I guess I'm wondering if you can speak to that idea that within the spiritual context of Zen or Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism in this case, Confucius' teachings, that we're not, it's not necessary to have verbal teachings. That there's something verbal teachings might be fine, but that there's a bigger, you know, there's something bigger than that, that kind of mind-to-mind teaching.
Well, a point that I sense that I've made over and over again that's extremely difficult for people to grasp is that when we are following a spiritual path, it's about behaving according to the way of that spiritual path.
Okay.
And the reason is that the behavior not only supersedes the thoughts and feelings, but eventually the thoughts and feelings gravitate to the behavior.
Hmm.
Like you just had a little experience with bowing.
Yeah.
And it's easy for people to resist bowing.
Right.
And it can be an indication that, you know, we're in our infancy in the West as far as Zen is concerned.
Yeah.
And there's never been a teaching, as far as I know, in the West that has emphasized so much the behavior.
Yeah.
And I think that historically in our culture we had formal culture where people learned how to treat the elderly, treat their mother and father, the respect that developed. And you could say to me, I don't respect my mother and father. And then if I said to you, oh, that's okay, but you have to act like you respect them. And eventually, by acting, you will become more respectable and you'll see respectable people, because the teaching always is Buddhas, sentient beings, and mind are one and the same.
Yeah.
That may be the most profound teaching a human could ever hear, but whether you embrace it or not through your behavior is a whole other question.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems like a That is I don't want to say a teaching, but...
Well, in your experience in life,
yeah,
I introduced you to Joshu Roshi.
Right.
And you couldn't really have a conversation with him.
Right.
But after you were there, you realized that it just didn't matter.
That's right.
And the more that you worked on yourself, in this case, I would say that means letting go of yourself.
Right.
You would come closer and closer to Joshu Roshi, and he would remind you of that with right. his behavior.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of at a loss for words because I'm really moved by this story, and it reminds me of, well, there's a couple of things. You've often said to me, you know, it's never about what you say. It's always about who you are when it comes to being, you know, any kind of a leader, really any kind of relationship, friendship, student, teacher, and all relationships that that's been a repeated teaching over the years, that it's never about what you say. It's always about who you are.
Yeah, because you can't hide who you are.
Right.
You can from right. some people temporarily, right. but anyone with an eye sees right through that.
Right.
And they don't necessarily say anything about that.
Right.
Because it's the most important thing is that you see that
right.
about yourself.
Well, right, Sonam. And I think it's a different thing to come to realize or come to see yourself as someone. Well, I guess what's coming up for me is the gratitude and the blessing of having met people like yourself, you know, as my father teacher, but like Joshu Roshi and other spiritual teachers, where you are quite literally lifted up by their presence and by who they are and not what they say. And that's such a blessing in the world that kind of path exists. And sometimes I get sad or I worry that, and at some level it's very subtle, and there also seems to be the sense that, well, if in the West our culture never wakes up to be able to appreciate such a sophisticated and subtle approach to life, it's a very sort of non-violent, non-aggressive approach to life, you know, seeing the Buddha nature in everything and therefore not being able to harm anything, not being able to exploit anything because you are everything. I don't see...
You should talk more about what prevents you from doing what you're talking about now.
Yeah.
Like I've seen you in the last 24 hours...
Yeah.
...react emotionally to something that you don't like.
Yeah,
and at least... sooner or later, what happened in that last 24 hours is that you came out of that and now can look back at it. And what I would just say to you is that there'd be no reason to get caught in the thinking and the feelings that you have about something. Just see it.
Yeah.
And keep doing what you do. In other words, you rely on your behavior,
right.
not somebody else's.
So are you saying there that rather than worrying about anyone other than myself waking up to that teaching, that I put my energy into embodying that in my own life.
Of course. I mean, that's always first, isn't it?
Well, and are you saying, definitely first, but is it also, like one time I've heard this from you, and also it's something I've heard elsewhere, that, you know, when you become a Buddha, all you see are Buddhas.
Mm-hmm. Of course. So, and that's what he's referring to by sameness.
Mm.
And I go back to Buddha, mind,
right,
and sentient beings are one and the same. So
yeah,
there's no variation to that.
Right.
And then beyond that, we say the 10,000 things. That means everything in the world that is sentient is Buddha.
Can I ask you a subtle question about that, Sunim? So when, in that case, having responded emotionally to something that happened that, you know, relatively minor thing, but definitely kind of caught me. When you see that you've gotten caught and you're wrapped up in a thought that's angry or resentful or whatever, and it kind of takes you over in that sense that you become like this sort of angry person. What I find with myself is that I'll often try to then like stop that feeling or thought and say, well, this isn't the right thing. You know, you have to act, like be nice, even if you don't feel like acting nice, you still have to be kind. But how do you actually, are you saying that you don't worry about the feeling, just like let it, it'll eventually dissipate? Because that's what happens. It eventually dissipates. But are you saying we shouldn't have those emotional reactions, or we just shouldn't talk about them? Like, was the problem that I expressed it to you?
Everybody has thoughts and feelings.
Right.
And they have it about everything, all of the 10,000 things.
Right.
But then they begin the process of dividing.
Right.
What they feel good about.
Right.
What they don't feel good about.
Right.
Now, what I'm saying to you is that there are some things that we don't feel good about, and there are things that we feel good about. But unless there's some direct action in that situation, for example, we had this horrific event in Israel, October the 7th.
Right.
Maybe, for me, the worst depravity I have ever heard. And I had an emotional reaction to that. But there's literally very little I can do other than changing myself and be sure that I'm not taking a side.
Right.
And that's what's happened. Some people take Israel's side. Some people took Hamas and the Palestinian side. And all I'm saying is that if you carry that kind of bias,
right,
it's going to cause two extreme behaviors on both sides. And I think it's obvious we have that, and
right,
we're in full disagreement with it.
Right.
And I think it was, this is how emotions can lead you down a path that people look at and go, oh my God, how can people do such a thing?
Right.
When we're led by our emotions, we can do anything.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, Sunim.
And again, if there was something you could do directly, but not based on your emotion, just in a practical sense, like if you happened to be there and you were caring for a wounded child, you wouldn't want to be angry about it or thrilled. You just would want to do the best you can to help that child.
Yeah.
That's where emotions get in the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as long as the behavior is correct, we can allow the emotion, which will dissipate.
Yeah.
I saw yours in the last 24 hours. I saw it with my own eyes and ears because you were talking to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can see it in retrospect that, wow.
Yeah, like where did that go?
There was something about nothing.
Right. I mean, it's information, but it's like the ignorance is that you have to act on it. Like you don't just hear the information. And,
well, not that you do act on it, but you don't act in response to the feeling of anger.
Yeah, right. Right.
It's kind of like when you're... I'm older, but in my generation, when you said to someone you love them, it was a really big deal.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that as I've aged, it seems more apparent to me that it just comes out of people in the kind of the most casual way, so that all meaning of it is lost. The other person hears it, just repeats it back, and you go on. And I'm just like, really, that's too bad.
Yeah.
It'd be better just if you could, you know, be in nowadays in somebody's presence that you talk about loving and your actions express that.
Yeah.
And if you speak, you might say, I just want you to know that whatever you need, I'll be here to take care of you.
Yeah.
And make sure that you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think in the West, love is used too often as a noun instead of a verb.
Right.
Love, because it's about doing loving kindness to each and every sentient creature.
Right.
And you have to be clean to do that.
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying is that Tumbledown was loving people by being who he really was. That was an act of love.
Well, and behavior is always virtually silent.
Yeah.
So we don't know exactly how he was caring for people, but...
Right.
Like, why would they be flocking around him?
Yeah, right.
Because they were aware, just like those piglets were with their mother. Their mother possessed something really important.
Yeah.
But no one can see that.
Yeah.
But you know when it leaves.
Yeah. Well, this is another topic, but it kind of leads me into the discussion or the thought that, in the West, we've really taken an academic and educational approach to sharing Zen and Buddhism. And I'm now recognizing the power in you pointing out to me that, you know, you have to become the teachings. And it's not good enough to know them and talk about them. You actually have to become the teachings. Like your example that, you know, I got kind of rattled around something someone did or didn't do yesterday. And if I'm honest about that, I say, well, yeah, at that moment I lost the teachings completely. Like I was now no longer seeing that person as anything other than a kind of sentient being.
Or well, you're attached to appearance,
right? Yeah, right. And there was no humility. I guess the lack of humility is what stands out to me. And to come back to...
You can never correct lack of humility other than behaviorally.
Behaviorally.
And humble is, it's a state of mind, but it's reached through behavior. I mean, when you're making prostrations, it's an act of humility if you want it to be. It can also be an act of arrogance if you want.
For sure.
But that's not the design. And for thousands of years in Zen culture and Buddhist culture, and other cultures as well, bowing is humility. It's lowering yourself in the presence of others.
Right.
Knowing intellectually there are no others. The moment you think of yourself as something better than someone else,
yeah,
you're in trouble.
Right. Absolutely.
You're a car salesman. You're a doctor.
Right.
You're
right.
You're not a sage.
Yeah.
A sage mind isn't like that. And it doesn't require anything, not even a full body in this case.
Tumble down. Well, I guess we should close up. Sunim, you mentioned before we started that you'd like to keep these around 30 minutes. I think we're closer to 40. And I guess on a final note, I would just say that I find it really endearing in these stories that David Hinton, the translator of this, I think you read this out of the Chuangzi, right? That he took the time to not only to translate the characters of these names, like I'm not sure what the Chinese pronunciation of tumbledown is, but usually in translations you just read the Chinese transliteration. But in this case, you know, you get to hear what the name actually means. So tumbledown is
imperial.
Imperial, tumbledown imperial. It's very endearing. And I asked him several months ago if he could give the meaning of your name, your character's, Hualsun. And he said, well, the kind of rough translation is living Zen, but the characters themselves mean, they are depicting a person at the mouth of a river and sort of drinking the water. And so it's sort of like the source of life, the source of water. And it really, it's just very touching that these stories and that even the names of the people in the stories come with such a rich consideration of life. So I really want to just say thank you, Sunim. It's really wonderful to be hearing these stories and talking about them with you, and I really appreciate your time. Okay.